of the two frigates had to be sold to the American government to pay for the other, and only two of the six steamships ever reached Greece. Neither of them, thanks to design failings, poor construction, corruption, and activities of Egyptian agents, to be trusted an inch. When he eventually arrived in Greece, on his yacht, in the spring of 1827, Cochrane took an even stronger line than Church. How, he demanded, could the Greek leaders make such fools of themselves, squabbling about where to hold their next assembly, when they should have been attacking the Turks and Egyptians, driving them out of the country before it was totally destroyed? His words had their effect. The two sides were forced into an agreement, according to which a new assembly should meet in Trezene, the ancient Trozen. By the end of March, both Church and Cochrane had withdrawn their objections and assumed their posts, and only a week or two later, the assembly resolved to offer the presidency of Greece to Kapodistria, who had now left the Russian service and was living quietly in Geneva. Meanwhile, in Athens, the Acropolis was still under siege. In an attempt to break the deadlock, it was decided early in 1827 to dispatch a force of 2,300 under the English Philhellene commander, Thomas Gordon. Gordon was soon joined by Karaiskakis, with several detachments of local troops, so that his numbers were probably not far short of 10,000 by the time Cochrane arrived at Piraeus in his flagship, the Hellas, shortly to be followed by Church in a commandeered schooner. Various plans of action were now put forward, but Cochrane had determined on a direct march on Athens and, as usual, rode roughshod over any opposition. "Where I command," he is quoted as saying, "all other authority ceases." Karaiskakis, realizing that such an advance would involve a dangerous crossing of an open plain almost certainly surrounded by Turkish cavalry, did not immediately accept this view. But a day or two later, he was shot by a Turkish musketeer, and there were no more objections. So it was agreed that at midnight on 5 May 1827, a force of 2,500 should disembark from the near side of Phaleron Bay and march on Athens, while the remainder, almost three times as many, should remain at Piraeus to await further orders. Karaiskakis had, of course, been perfectly right. But if the plan was foolhardy, its execution was little short of shameful. Gordon commented afterwards. As the admiral had nothing to do with the motions of the troops when once ashore, and the general, Church, satisfied with having sketched a disposition, stayed in his vessel till daylight, the captains, all on a footing of equality, acted independently, halting where they chose, so that the column was scattered over a space of 4 miles, the front within cannon shot of Athens, the rear close to the sea, and the soldiers, unprovided with spades and pickaxes, dug the earth with their daggers in order to cover themselves from the charge of horse. Rashid attacked at dawn, with all too foreseeable results. The Greeks lost 1,500 men, more than any other single day since the beginning of the war. When, after a comfortable night's rest, Cochrane and Church disembarked from their respective ships, it was to find the survivors exhausted and terrified, dragging themselves back to the shore and clambering into the small boats in which they hoped to escape to safety. Church, in an attempt to restore his reputation, held out heroically with a handful of men at Phaleron for 3 more weeks, but by the end of the month, heat and thirst had compelled him to surrender. The garrison on the Acropolis gave in a few days later. Who was to blame? In one way or another, just about everyone. Cochrane for his overweening arrogance and refusal to listen to other wiser men. Church for not standing up to him. Both of them for staying on board their ships when they should have been with their men. The Greek captains for demonstrating once again their hopeless lack of discipline and inability to agree on a supreme commander. Their failure proved a tragedy, and it served them right. Meanwhile, the question of European intervention dragged on, as ambassadors shuttled between London, Paris, and St. Petersburg. British interests were in the capable hands of the Foreign Secretary, George Canning, who in April 1827 succeeded Lord Liverpool as Prime Minister. It was largely through his efforts that the Treaty of London was signed by Britain, France, and Russia on 6 July. By its terms, Greece would enjoy autonomy, theoretically as a dependency of Turkey, in that she would pay an annual tribute, but effectively independent, as the three powers would recognize by establishing commercial relations with her. She and Turkey must conclude an armistice within a month. Canning later shortened this to a fortnight, after which, if they had failed to do so, the powers would intervene. For the Greeks, this was good news indeed. Turkey, they knew, would reject any idea of an armistice, so intervention was virtually certain. Events were to prove them right. Some months before, the Sultan had appointed Muhammad Ali titular supreme commander of all land and sea forces in Greece, Turkish as well as Egyptian. Muhammad Ali had thereupon raised a new army of nearly 15,000 and a new fleet consisting of 3 Turkish ships of the line, 60 smaller vessels, 5 of them French-built, 40 transports, and 6 fireships. All told, they carried some 3,500 guns. This was the force which dropped anchor on 7 September in the Bay of Navarino, where Ibrahim was waiting. The 3 Allied navies hastened to Navarino, but their respective admirals had strict orders not to go directly into battle. They were first to do everything in their power to encourage all Turkish and Egyptian warships to return peaceably to Constantinople or Alexandria, though Canning made it clear that if they persisted in remaining in Greece, the orders of the British admiral, Sir Edward Codrington, were to be enforced, if necessary, and when all other means are exhausted, by cannon shot. Codrington, another veteran of Trafalgar, where he had commanded HMS Orion, had been appointed Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean the previous December. He was the first to reach Navarino, where he was joined by his French colleague, the Comte de Regny, a few days later. The Russians having not yet arrived on 25 September, the 2 admirals, accompanied by a few of their senior officers and by Codrington's son Henry, a midshipman on his father's ship, had an interview with Ibrahim in his tent just outside the neighboring town of Pylos. The conversation, as recorded by Henry Codrington, was polite and cordial, accompanied by quantities of coffee and the smoking of enormous jewel-studded chibouks. It went very much as might have been imagined, with Codrington issuing his courteous warning and Ibrahim agreeing to take no action until he received new instructions from Alexandria and Constantinople. All the same, it is a pity that no minutes were taken, for it soon became clear that the two sides had very different ideas of the conclusions. Ibrahim apparently believed that the Greeks, as well as the Turks, were bound by the temporary armistice. He also assumed that there would be no Allied objection to his taking supplies and provisions to the Turkish garrison at Patras. The Greeks, for their part, saw no reason to call a halt. They, after all, had accepted the terms of the Treaty of London. It was the Turks who had rejected them. Thus it was that, in the last days of September, while Church was leading an expedition against Patras, Ibrahim sailed for the city with a fleet of no less than 48 ships, far more than could have been needed for a simple supply drop. But he never reached it. Codrington was there to block him, and ferocious equinoctial gales did the rest. Ibrahim then changed his tactics. The admirals might frustrate him by sea, but they were powerless to check him on land. Very well, he would continue with the devastation of the Peloponnese. With the agreement of 25 September, now little more than a dead letter, the 3 admirals, Codrington and de Regny, had now been joined by the Russian, the Dutch-born Rear Admiral Count Haydn, decided on a show of strength. The 10 French naval officers on board the Egyptian ships as advisors were summoned back at once, and in the late morning of 20 October, Codrington, in his flagship, the Asia, led the 3 fleets together, numbering 11 ships of the line, 8 large frigates and 8 smaller vessels through the narrow entrance to the Bay of Navarino. Both sides were still under orders not to begin hostilities, but in so tense a situation, it was impossible to tell whether any individual action was merely provocative or actually aggressive. Moreover, unlike the Allied admirals, the Turkish and Egyptian commanders had agreed on no overall plan to guide them. Sooner or later, battle was inevitable. It began at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and continued until about 6. Those 4 hours saw the last naval battle ever fought in which no steamship took part. More remarkable still was the fact that the ships were all lying at anchor, at close quarters in a small bay. They could maneuver only by swinging around on the anchor cables so that the guns along their broadsides could face their chosen target. Dr. Howe unforgettably described the scene. The Turkish ships, more than triple the number of their opponents, opened all their broadsides, and, seconded by the batteries on shore, poured such tremendous volleys of shot as, if well directed, must have annihilated the Europeans. But the latter sent back, if a smaller, yet a far more destructive fire, for every gun was pointed, every shot told. The Allies, sending out their boats, cut the cables of the Turkish fire vessels, and, setting fire to them, let them drive down upon their own fleet. In a few minutes, several ships of war, taking fire, added to the horror of the scene already terrible. The 2 long lines of ships, from which roared nearly 2,000 cannon, the blazing fire ships, driving to and fro among the huge Turkish vessels, whose falling mast and shattered hulls began to show how the battle went. The sea covered with spars and half-burnt masses of wood, to which clung thousands of sailors, escaped from their exploded vessels. The lines of batteries upon the shore, which blazed away all the time, and were covered by the whole Turkish army most anxiously watching a scene upon which their own fate depended. But a contest could not be long where one side had only a vast superiority of force, directed by blind fury alone against cool courage, discipline, and naval skill. Strangely enough, the Allied losses at Navarino were comparatively light. Not a single ship was sunk, the casualties amounting to 174 killed and 475 wounded. For the Ottoman fleet, however, it was a very different story. From the start, it had been at a disadvantage. Its supreme commander, Ibrahim Pasha, missed the whole engagement, being still away in the Peloponnese. The Egyptian admiral, Moharram Bey, had no stomach for the fight and had left with the French officers before it began. There remained only the Turk, Tahir Pasha, whose flagship was sunk at an early stage of the battle. Of the 89 fighting ships under his command, only 29 survived. Codrington estimated that some 6,000 Turks and Egyptians were killed, and another 4,000 wounded. The pendulum had swung dramatically. Little more than 5 months before, on 6 May, the Turkish recovery of Athens had seemed to sound a death knell to Greek hopes. After Navarino, Greek independence was certain. All was not quite over. Ibrahim's troops, some 24,000 of them, remained in the devastated Peloponnese. It was not until September 1828 that they were finally embarked on Egyptian ships and returned to Alexandria. Fighting continued, too, beyond the Gulf of Corinth. The further the Greeks could advance to the north, the more territory they could claim for their new state. Church in the west and Demetrios Ypsilanis in the east pushed steadily forward, the former as far as Arta, the latter to Thermopylae, opposite the northern tip of Euboea, although he was unable to dislodge the Turks from Athens itself. Meanwhile, Kapodistria had finally arrived to take up his presidency. He immediately antagonized the revolutionary captains by making no effort to conceal his contempt for the way in which they had failed to unite, endlessly bickering and squabbling amongst themselves whilst the fate of their country hung in the balance. But he worked 16 hours a day to rebuild the country, and his immense reputation abroad had a decisive effect on the deliberations of the London Conference, which now had the task of drawing the boundaries of the new Greek state. In September 1828, the ambassadors to Constantinople of the three Allied powers met on the island of Poros to consider this specific question, and 3 months later they announced their recommendation: a line running from Arta in the west to Volos in the east, with the inclusion of the islands of Euboea, Samos, and possibly Crete. The only problem was Turkey, which refused outright to come to the negotiating table. This was finally resolved only by the Treaty of Adrianople, which ended a Russian-Turkish war in September 1829. By its terms, the Turks finally agreed to abide by whatever future decisions on Greece might eventually be taken by the Allies. Finally, on 3 February 1830 in London, Greece was declared an independent nation under the protection of Britain, France, and Russia. It was to be some years yet before peace returned. Kapodistria was assassinated on 9 October 1831, and the country was plunged back into confusion. But in July 1832, the Turks gave their final approval to the Arta-Volos line, though not to the inclusion of Samos and Crete, and Greece became a sovereign state. Even then, however, its sovereignty was not absolute. The Western powers had determined that it should be a monarchy, and had selected as its king the 17-year-old Prince Otto of Wittelsbach, son of King Ludwig I of Bavaria. He arrived in Nauplia on the morning of 6 February 1833, and was given a tremendous welcome, cheered everywhere to the echo. Greece's long-cherished dream had finally become a reality, but her troubles were by no means over. Chapter 26. Muhammad Ali and North Africa. The Ottoman Sultan Mahmud II deserved better than he got. He was, in many ways, an enlightened ruler and reformer, who did everything within his power to modernize his creaking empire. In 1826, he had got rid of the Janissaries, for 500 years the empire's crack military corps, but now becoming increasingly mutinous by the simple expedient of massacring them wholesale. He established a new army under his own direct control and trained by German instructors with a military college modeled on Napoleon's Saint-Cyr. He slashed the power of the religious ulema, depriving them of their secular responsibilities. He centralized and, to some extent, streamlined his civil service. He virtually introduced modern principles of education. He inaugurated a postal service and the first Turkish language newspaper in Istanbul. He established a school of medicine and introduced new laws on public health. Finally, and perhaps rather sadly, he abolished the old Turkish dress. Away went the long robes and turbans, the billowing pantaloons and soft slippers. In came the fez, the frock coat, the European trousers, and the black leather boots. It was sad indeed for him that he had to preside over the loss of his navy, of southern Greece, and of several other previously Ottoman territories, and then was still obliged to cope with that perennial thorn in his flesh, Muhammad Ali in Cairo. As a reward for his intervention in the Peloponnese, Muhammad Ali had expected the Pashalik of Syria. Mahmud, however, had fobbed him off with Crete, which his viceroy considered shamefully inadequate. In the spring of 1832, Muhammad Ali therefore sent his son Ibrahim with an army to Syria, instructing him to occupy it by force. Ibrahim obeyed him to the letter. Gaza fell, and Jerusalem, and, after a short siege, Acre. Ibrahim then swept north to Damascus and Aleppo, whence he led his army through Anatolia until he was threatening Istanbul itself. With his capital now in a state not far short of panic, the Sultan sent an urgent plea to London for aid. The British Foreign Secretary, Lord Palmerston, however, was not interested. Mahmud had no choice but to call upon his old enemy, Russia. Tsar Nicholas, ever ready to meddle in Turkish affairs, asked nothing better. Early in 1833, he landed 18,000 troops at Scutari, directly across the Bosphorus from Istanbul. Against such a force, Ibrahim knew that he had no chance. Sensibly enough, he decided to negotiate. By this time, Palmerston had woken up to the seriousness of the situation, as had the French government. Together, they prevailed upon the Porte to insist on the Russians' withdrawal in return for certain major concessions. Muhammad Ali was confirmed in the pashaliks of Egypt and of Crete, and was now, in addition, presented with that of Syria, which included Damascus, Tripoli, Aleppo, and Adana. Simultaneously, but in a separate treaty, Mahmud confirmed an offensive and defensive agreement with Russia, a secret clause of which gave Russian warships the right to pass freely through the straits from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean, a privilege denied to all other foreign powers without Turkish consent. The Sultan had successfully averted both the Russian and the Egyptian threats, but he had paid a heavy price. With the whole of the southeastern Mediterranean under his control, Muhammad Ali was now a serious rival, and although Syria had been specifically awarded to him for his lifetime only, Mahmud was well aware that he had every intention of turning his possessions into what would effectively be an independent hereditary monarchy. 5 years later, he was proved right. When in 1838, Muhammad Ali refused to pay his annual tribute to the Porte, the Sultan seized his opportunity and the following year declared war, sending an army of 24,000 and a supporting fleet to Syria with explicit orders to drive out the Egyptians once and for all. The result, from his point of view, was catastrophic. On 24 June, Ibrahim's army, though heavily outnumbered, routed Mahmud's forces at Nizib in northern Syria. Thanks to generous Egyptian bribes, vast numbers of Turkish troops deserted, while the commander of the fleet, presumably for much the same reason, sailed it straight to Alexandria, and on 1 July 1839, the very day that Sultan Mahmud died in Istanbul, handed it over to Muhammad Ali. The French, who believed their own best interest to lie with Egypt, declined to take any action, but the other powers were horrified. On 15 July 1840, a conference in London, presided over by Palmerston himself, and including both Austria and Prussia, presented Muhammad Ali with an ultimatum. He must withdraw all his troops from northern Syria and Crete, and return the Turkish fleet to Istanbul. If he did so, he would be recognized as hereditary Pasha of Egypt, and Pasha of southern Syria for his lifetime. If he refused, the British and Russian fleets would together put both Egypt and Syria under a blockade. In the hopes of receiving substantial aid from France, which, it need hardly be said, was not ultimately forthcoming, Muhammad Ali refused, and the British, at least, were as good as their word. That autumn, a British squadron under Captain Charles Napier bombarded the forts of both Beirut and Acre, and destroyed them. It even landed an expeditionary force, also commanded by Napier, which, with the help of the local Arabs, who had greatly suffered under Muhammad Ali's regime, easily defeated the Egyptian army of occupation at the Battle of Bulharsif, one of the Royal Navy's most unlikely victories. The French, furious at what they denounced as unprovoked aggression, threatened war, but were not taken very seriously. As King Louis-Philippe himself was later to point out, there was all the difference in the world between threatening war and making it. Napier then sailed on to Alexandria, which would surely have suffered the same fate as the two Syrian ports if Muhammad Ali had not agreed to negotiate. He hastily returned the Turkish fleet to Istanbul and resumed his annual tribute to the Sultan, withdrawing altogether from Syria and Crete. The old ruffian lived on until 1849, dying at the age of 80. He continued to rule as hereditary Pasha of Egypt and Sudan, but always under Ottoman suzerainty. And he made no further attempts at territorial expansion. He was a man of high intelligence and, we are told, great personal charm. He was also energetic and efficient. But his rule in Egypt certainly marked a dramatic improvement on what had gone before. But he was uneducated and possessed no real political vision or ideology. He governed by Ottoman principles, and though he went some way towards creating a new and more forward-looking society, much of his time was spent consolidating his own position and resisting repeated attempts by sultan after sultan to get rid of him. In this, he was remarkably successful. The dynasty that he established was to last well over 100 years, until the middle of the 20th century, and if he missed his opportunity of laying the foundations of a modern Egyptian state, he had at least cleared the way for his successors. If they too failed, the blame for their failure can hardly be attributed to him. One April day in 1827, Hussein Dey of Algiers angrily struck the French consul 3 times with his fly whisk. Outraged at such treatment of its official representative, the French government dispatched a naval squadron to the city to demand an apology and reparations. When the Dey refused, the consul and all French residents were put on board the ships and Algiers blockaded. Then in July 1830, a French expeditionary force landed at Sidi Farouk, some 20 miles to the west of Algiers, while the city itself was simultaneously subjected to a formidable naval bombardment. It fell a few weeks later. The Dey went into exile. The French occupation of Algeria had begun. The occupiers did not, however, have it all their own way. As early as 1832, fighting broke out in the interior under a 25-year-old resistance leader named Abdelkader, and continued for the next 15 years. But by the time Abdelkader surrendered in 1847 to Marshal Thomas Robert Bugeaud, French colonists were pouring into Algiers. Already by 1841, there were over 37,000 of them, and well before the end of the century, they accounted for a good 10% of the total population. It was, they found, an easy place in which to settle. Indeed, many different peoples had already done so. Carthaginians, Romans, Byzantines, Arabs, and Turks. Recently, the power of the Barbary corsairs had grown to the point where they were virtually the masters of the land, though not its governors, if only because they made no attempt to govern. What is unquestionable is the fact that under the French army and Bugeaud's Bureau Arabe, Algeria was more efficiently and more fairly administered than it had been for many centuries. Along the coast and in the northern mountains, the Algerian climate is typical of the Mediterranean, with warm, dry summers and mild, rainy winters. Before the arrival of the French, the land had been by no means uncivilized. As early as 1834, a French general noted that illiteracy hardly existed, since every village boasted 2 schools. But although technically under Ottoman domination, its successive governments had been chronically unstable. Of the Dey's 28 predecessors, over half had met a violent death. Property rights were vague and, to the French, unimportant. Addressing the National Assembly in 1840, Bugeaud made his own opinion clear. Wherever there is fresh water and fertile land, there we have to put settlers, colons, without concerning ourselves as to whom these lands belong. On the other hand, there were about 1,000,000 hectares, some 4,000 square miles, which had been the property of the Ottoman government and which the French could be said to have inherited, together with other vast tracts which had been taken over, either because they were lying uncultivated or as the result of some malfeasance on the part of the former owners. In the early days, Bugeaud's regime was fairly dictatorial, with relatively little comprehension between rulers and ruled. Gradually, however, the French attitude became more enlightened. Soon after the establishment of the Second Empire in 1852, Napoleon III was to say that, while he hoped that an increased number of settlers would keep Algeria French, it should be remembered that France's first duty was to its 3 million Arabs. Algeria was not a French province, but an Arab country, a European colony and a French camp. Military rule, however, was to continue until after the fall of the Second Empire in 1870. Before that time, the Governor General of Algeria, a title first given to Bugeaud in 1845, was almost invariably a high-ranking army officer. It was only in 1870 that the colon, otherwise known as the pied noir, by now over 200,000 strong, insisted on more control over their own affairs, similar to that enjoyed by their compatriots across the Mediterranean. Algeria was now formally annexed, constituting an integral part of France itself, and was governed through the French Ministry of the Interior in Paris. Because of this, Algeria's position was essentially different from that of her neighbors to east and west, Tunisia and Morocco. Here, too, French influence was strong, but since there was relatively little immigration, these two countries were deemed to be protectorates only and were dealt with by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at the Quai d'Orsay. Tunisia, too, had been technically an Ottoman province, although in fact entirely autonomous. When in 1830 the French occupied Algiers, the reigning Bey of Tunis had cautiously accepted French assurances of non-intervention. But then in 1835, the Ottoman Empire seized the opportunity of a disputed succession in neighboring Libya to depose the ruling dynasty there and re-establish direct Ottoman rule. Thereafter, Tunisia found herself most delicately placed, sandwiched as she was between the two great powers of France and Turkey, both of which were casting covetous eyes upon her. It says much for the Bey and his successors that she performed a successful balancing act until 1881, when the French, on the flimsy enough pretext that a bunch of Tunisian tribesmen had settled in Algerian territory, invaded the country, transferred to France the Bey's authority in finance and foreign affairs, and appointed a French resident minister. The Sultanate of Morocco, the only North African country with coastal exposure to both the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, was in a different position again. Because of its lack of natural harbors, its rugged, mountainous interior, and the immense distance separating it from imperial centers in the east, it was still in the middle of the 19th century, very largely isolated. It was this isolation, encouraged by successive rulers, which had enabled it firstly to preserve, to a far greater degree than was possible elsewhere, its ancient Islamic, Berber, and African traditions, and secondly to resist exterior pressures, notably that of the Spanish Reconquista in the 15th and 16th centuries. Morocco thus remained the only Arab country never to have become part of the Ottoman Empire, which for so long controlled virtually all the rest of the Arab world. The arrival of the French in neighboring Algeria could not, however, be ignored. Relations deteriorated sharply in 1844, after the rebel Abdelkader took refuge in Morocco and the Sultan dispatched an army to the border. The French responded by bombarding Tangier in early August and Mogador 10 days later. On the 14th, they virtually destroyed Sultan Moulay Abdelrahman's army at Isli near Oujda. The Sultan was obliged, inter alia, to promise that he would intern or expel the rebel should he ever again enter Moroccan territory. He proved as good as his word. In 1847, when Abdelkader sought refuge for the second time, he was arrested by Moroccan troops and forced to surrender. It comes as a relief to report that the French were merciful towards him. He was to spend the rest of his life in honorable exile in Damascus. On the Sultan's death in 1859, the spotlight briefly switches to Spain, with which a bitter dispute took place over the boundaries of the Spanish enclave at Ceuta. This ended in a declaration of war by Madrid, and in the following year, the Spanish capture of Tetuan, the Sultan being obliged to agree to a large indemnity and a considerable increase in the size of the Ceuta enclave. Meanwhile, the British and the Italians were also hoping somehow to win their slice of the Moroccan cake, but both were bought off by France. Britain agreed to give the French a free hand there in return for a French undertaking not to interfere with her own plans in Egypt, while Italy did much the same in relation to Libya. In 1880, the British, French, Spanish, Germans, Italians, and Americans had concluded a convention at Madrid, which, in theory at least, virtually guaranteed Moroccan independence. But this did not prevent France from concluding, in 1904, with full British connivance, a secret treaty with Spain, agreeing on respective spheres of influence within the country. This was the situation when, at the end of March 1905, Kaiser Wilhelm II arrived at Tangier on the liner Hamburg and, as so often, put the cat among the pigeons. In his reply to the speech of welcome, he declared first for the complete sovereignty and independence of the Sultan, second for the integrity of his realm, and third for a Morocco open to the peaceful competition of all nations, without annexation or monopoly. It all sounded innocuous enough, but to the European powers it was clearly a deliberate attempt to put a spoke into the French and, to a lesser extent, Spanish wheel. The previous year, the Kaiser had proposed that Germany should lease Port Mahon in Menorca from Spain, an idea that had met a frigid reception from both France and Britain, the island being situated where it could command the approaches to Toulon and on a direct line between the two vital British bases of Malta and Gibraltar. The last thing either nation wanted was to have Wilhelm meddling once again in the affairs of the Western Mediterranean. The whole issue was finally hammered out and, it seemed, satisfactorily resolved in 1906, when a conference of the signatories to the 1880 Convention was called at Algeciras to discuss the whole Moroccan question. This reaffirmed the integrity of the country and the economic equality of the powers, but sanctioned French and Spanish policing of Moroccan ports and the collection of customs dues. Even now, the story was not quite over. In 1907, France, always eager to increase her influence in North Africa, occupied Casablanca. Then Abdelhafid, the brother of the Sultan Abdelaziz, led a rebellion against him, claiming that he had betrayed Muslim traditions. Abdelaziz took refuge in Tangier, while in Fez, Abdelhafid was proclaimed Sultan. He was duly recognized in the following year by the European powers, but never managed to impose order throughout the country, and eventually, with disorder steadily increasing, was obliged to ask the French to rescue him. The result was the Treaty of Fez in 1912, by the terms of which Morocco became a French protectorate. Tangier, long the seat of the European diplomatic missions, was put under separate administration. Finally, a word about Libya. Anyone who has ever visited the country will have been struck by its extraordinary geography. To the west, with its capital at Tripoli, is Tripolitania, where, in sites like Leptis, Magna, or Sabratha, we can still feel the impact of ancient Rome. To the east is Cyrenaica, based on Benghazi, which at Apollonia, Cyrene, and elsewhere immediately takes us back to the world of classical Greece. Between the two, however, are some 600 or 700 miles of virtually nothing, except the nondescript little town of Sirte, at what is roughly the halfway mark. The country has probably been kept together by two things only, the Senussi order that preached a puritanical form of Islam, though even this was largely concentrated in Cyrenaica, and later Italian colonialism. Like its neighbors, it had been more or less autonomous, although under nominal Turkish rule, until in 1835 the Ottoman Empire took advantage of one of the endless disputes over the succession to reimpose a direct government. For the next 77 years, the country was administered by civil servants from Istanbul, until in 1911 Italy took over, gave it its present name, and governed it until after the Second World War. Chapter 27. The 48. When on Wednesday, 12 January 1848, the 38th birthday of King Ferdinand II, the people of Palermo rose up against their Bourbon masters, they could have had no idea of what they were starting. Risings in the kingdom were nothing new. There had been unsuccessful ones in Naples in 1820 and in Piedmont in 1821. In Sicily itself, there had been another as recently as 1837, sparked off by an epidemic of cholera, the first appearance of the disease in Western Europe. But the consequent angry manifestations had been relatively easily dealt with. What happened in 1848, the 48, as Italy remembers it, was something else. It was a revolution, and by the end of the year, it had been followed by other revolutions in Paris, Vienna, Naples, Rome, Venice, Florence, Lucca, Parma, Modena, Berlin, Milan, Krakow, Warsaw, and Budapest. Already, as the year opened, student riots had prompted the authorities to close the university. Several eminent citizens, known for their liberal views, had been arrested, and an unsigned manifesto circulated calling upon the people to rise up on the king's birthday. A large proportion of the insurgents were mountain brigands, the forerunners of the mafiosi of today, or simple peasants, few of whom probably had much idea of what they were fighting for, apart from a generally better life, but they fought no less fiercely for that. Many of the smaller villages and towns were devastated, as was much of the countryside. The Bourbons had some 7,000 troops in the Palermo garrison, but they proved almost useless. Communications were bad, the roads execrable, and they could not be everywhere at once. In despair, they decided to bombard the city, a decision which they soon had cause to regret. The infuriated mob fell on the royal palace, sacked it, sparing, thank heaven, the Palatine Chapel, and set fire to the state records and archives. The garrison retreated and soon returned to Naples. In the following days, a committee of government was formed under the presidency of the 70-year-old Sicilian patriot and former Neapolitan minister of marine, Ruggero Settimo. Meanwhile, the revolt spread to all the main cities except Messina, which held back through jealousy of Palermo, and well over 100 villages where the support of the peasantry had by now been assured by lavish promises of land. It encountered no opposition worthy of the name. By the end of the month, the island was virtually free of royal troops, and on 5 February, Settimo announced that the evils of war had ceased, and that thenceforth an era of happiness had begun for Sicily. He failed to mention that the citadel of Messina was still in Neapolitan hands. Nonetheless, it was clear to King Ferdinand that he had his back to the wall. Owing to almost continuous demonstrations in Naples on the Sicilian model, on 29 January he offered a liberal constitution to both parts of his kingdom, providing for a bicameral legislature and a modest degree of franchise. "The game is up," wrote the horrified Austrian ambassador Prince Schwarzenberg to his chief Metternich. "The king and his ministers have completely lost their heads." Metternich simply scribbled in the margin, "I defy the ministers to lose what they never possessed." The news that reached him towards the end of February must have distressed him still more. In Paris, the citizen king, Louis Philippe, had been toppled on 24 February and a republic proclaimed. Now the landslide began. Ferdinand, who had enjoyed a brief popularity after his grant of a constitution, was more than ever execrated. Liberal constitutions were no longer enough. The Sicilians, meanwhile, had refused the offer. Sicily, they coldly informed him, does not demand new institutions, but the restoration of rights which have been hers for centuries. In Palermo, he was declared deposed, the Bourbon flag being replaced by the revolutionary tricolor, and that strange device of a sort of rimless wheel with three legs as its spokes. Sicily was now truly independent, for the first time since the 14th century. The difficulty was that it lacked any machinery for its effective administration. Armed bands sprang up throughout the island. Kidnappings and protection rackets were rife. But all this was symptomatic of a greater malaise. Trade plummeted, unemployment soared, the legal system virtually collapsed. To most Sicilians, the year 1848 was no longer the year of revolution. It was the year of destruction and chaos. Towards the end of August, Ferdinand sent a combined military and naval force under Field Marshal Carlo Falangieri to restore order on the island. The rebels fought back, and the age-old hatred between Neapolitans and Sicilians gave rise to atrocities on both sides, to the point where the British and French admirals in Sicilian waters, shocked by the bloodshed and brutality, persuaded Ferdinand to grant a 6-month armistice, where one might have thought was an opportunity to end the stalemate, but every offer of settlement was refused out of hand. As a result, Filangieri captured Taormina on 2 April 1849 and Catania on the 7th. On 15 May, he entered Palermo. By their inefficiency, their lack of unity, and their refusal to compromise, the Sicilians had perfectly demonstrated how a revolution should not be run. Their neighbors, the Greeks, had shown similar defects, but they had the active support of the Western powers. The Sicilians had not, and they paid the price. The revolution in Venice, though it too was ultimately unsuccessful, was handled with far more assurance and skill. Already in June 1844, three young Venetian naval officers, the brothers Attilio and Emilio Bandera, and their friend, Domenico Moro, had sailed from Corfu to Calabria, where they planned to join a minor insurrection that had broken out against Bourbon Naples. Their expedition was ridiculously quixotic. They had made virtually no preparations, had taken no precautions, and were almost immediately arrested. A month later, they were executed in the valley of Rovito, near Cosenza. The news of their deaths had an immediate impact on Italian public opinion. If three Venetians, to say nothing of several fellow martyrs from Perugia, Rimini, and other cities, were prepared to die for Naples, then Italian unity must, after all, be something more than an empty dream. It seemed unthinkable that such heroes should have perished in vain. In Venice, it was now generally agreed that the moment had come when the whole population of the city must speak out with a single voice, and the voice with which it spoke was that of Daniel Manin. He was born in Venice on 13 May 1804. His Jewish father had converted to Christianity in his youth and had adopted the name of his godfather Pietro Manin, brother of the last Doge Lodovico. Determined to be a lawyer like his father, Daniel had published his first work, a legal treatise on wills, when he was 12. By the time he was awarded his doctorate at Padua University, at the age of 21, he had a good working knowledge of Latin, Greek, Hebrew, French, and German, as well as Italian and his native Venetian. Brought up by his father to share his own republican and liberal ideas, he had already been politically active for some 16 years when in 1847, with nationalist feeling growing throughout Italy, he launched what he called his lotta legale, or legal struggle, against Austrian despotism. He was not at this stage demanding full Venetian independence, merely home rule under the Habsburg Empire. Only when this had been refused, as he knew full well that it would be, would he call his fellow citizens to arms. The first moment of open defiance came on 30 December 1847, when the distinguished academic Niccolò Tommasio gave a lecture. Its ostensible subject was the state of Italian literature. In fact, it proved to be a direct attack on the Austrian censorship. At the end, he circulated a petition, which was signed by over 600 leading names in Venice and the Veneto. As a further indication of their anger, the Venetians followed the example set a few weeks before by the Milanese and gave up smoking. They had always made a point of not applauding the concerts by the Austrian military band in the piazza. Henceforth, at the opening bars, they turned on their heels and left. A week later, Manin followed up with a 16-point charter, demanding, inter alia, vastly increased rights for all Italians under Austrian rule, a separate North Italian government answerable to the emperor alone, and finally the complete abolition of censorship. This, for the imperial authorities, was the last straw. On 18 January 1848, Manin and Tommasio were arrested and marched to the old prisons next to the Doge's palace. Once the Venetians had discovered where they were, crowds collected daily to stand in respect, bareheaded and silent on the riva below. In early March, to everyone's surprise, the two were acquitted, but the Austrian chief of police insisted that they should remain in prison. It was a disastrous mistake. The annual carnival was cancelled, and Manin's fellow lawyers took over all his work without pay. The Venetians, however, aware that the Austrian army in Venetia Lombardy, under the 81-year-old Marshal Josef Radetzky, numbered no less than 75,000, still hesitated to take up arms. Then on 17 March, the postal steamer from Trieste brought the news that Vienna itself was in revolt, that the rebels had triumphed, and that just 4 days before, the hated Prince Metternich had fled for his life. Overnight, the situation was transformed. As the word spread through the city, an immense crowd flocked to the governor's residence on the south side of the piazza, shouting, "Furore manin et amasio." The people, it was clear, would no longer be gainsaid. The Austrian governor, Count Palfi, eventually appeared at the window and protested that even if he had wished to release the prisoners, he had no power to do so. The crowd, led by Manin's 16-year-old son, Giorgio, then steamed across the piazza to the prison and began hammering on the doors, which were finally opened. It was typical of Daniel Manin, always a lawyer, that he should have refused to leave the building until he had an official order to do so, an order which Palfi, at the urgings of his near-hysterical wife, hastily signed. Only then did he and Tomasio emerge, to be carried shoulder-high to the governor's residence. The crowds made as if to break down the doors, but Manin restrained them. "Do not forget," he told them, "that there can be no true liberty, and that liberty cannot last where there is no order." Only when they had calmed down did he allow them to bear him off to his home. Metternich's resignation and flight on 13 March had inspired Italy to action, but had left Austria in chaos. The government was rudderless, the army bewildered and uncertain of its loyalties. Here, unmistakably, was the signal to insurgents and revolutionaries throughout Italy. In Milan, the great insurrection, known to all Italians as the Cinque Giornate, the 5 days of 18 to 21 March, drove the Austrians from the city and instituted a republican government. On the last of those days, in Turin, a stirring front-page article appeared in the newspaper, Il Risorgimento, written by its editor, Count Camillo Cavour. "The supreme hour has sounded," he wrote. "One way alone is open for the nation, for the government, for the king: war." 2 days later, King Charles Albert of Savoy proclaimed from Piedmont his country's readiness to give full support to Venetia Lombardy in the forthcoming struggle, together with his own intention personally to lead his army into battle. Unfortunately, although able immediately to mobilize some 70,000 men, Piedmont was hopelessly unprepared for war. In her entire army, we are told, there was not a single map of Lombardy. Unfortunately, too, the king was to prove uninspired as a general, certainly no match for old Radetzky, who had been commanding armies since before Charles Albert was born. On the other hand, although the eventual outcome of the hostilities between Austria and Piedmont might have been a foregone conclusion from a military point of view, the king must have been greatly encouraged by the reaction of the other Italian states. Grand Duke Leopold II of Tuscany at once dispatched an army composed of both regular troops and volunteers. Rather more surprisingly, there was a similar response from King Ferdinand of Naples, who sent a force of 16,000 under a huge Calabrian general called Guglielmo Pepe. Strategically, these contributions probably made little difference. They showed, however, beyond all possible doubt, that the cause was a national, Italian one. As they took their places beside the Piedmontese, Charles Albert's fellow rulers saw themselves not as allies but as compatriots. Daniel Manin alone made no pretense of fighting for Italy. His cause was Venice. A few months before, he might have welcomed the news that arrived on the evening of his release from prison, to the effect that the emperor had agreed to the principle of constitutional government for Venetia Lombardy. But such an offer was now too little and too late. He was resolved to settle for nothing less than the expulsion of all Austrians from Venetian territory. On the morning of March 22, a date now commemorated in the name of Venice's principal shopping street, he and his men occupied the arsenal without a struggle and commandeered all the arms and ammunition that were stored there. He then led a triumphal procession to the piazza, where he formally proclaimed a republic, ending his speech with a ringing cry of Viva San Marco. It was the first time that the words had been heard in public for over half a century. Palfi, meanwhile, had signed a formal act of capitulation, leaving effective power in the hands of the provisional government which was to be formed, and undertaking that all Austrian troops would be evacuated without their arms to Trieste. Venice was once more a republic, but it was plain from its earliest days that that republic was in mortal danger. The Austrians had retreated, but they were by no means beaten. The revolution, after all, had been confined only to the major towns. Radetzky was still in control of most of the countryside, and after the fall of Vicenza on 10 June, the whole of the Venetian terra firma was back in Austrian hands. Venice could not hope to stand alone, and so on 4 July, the newly elected Venetian Assembly reluctantly voted for fusion with Piedmont, where Cavour was calling ever more insistently for the unification of Italy. It was a tragic day for Daniel Manin, who at once handed over to an interim ministry and retired from public life. A few days later, he was spotted in the uniform of a private in the Civic Guard, on sentry go in the Piazzetta. Meanwhile, 3,000 Piedmontese troops were billeted in the city. For many Venetians, it was almost as bad as having the Austrians back again. Each day, the Pope shows himself more lacking in any practical sense. Born and brought up in a liberal family, he has been formed in a bad school. A good priest, he has never turned his mind towards matters of government. Warm of heart and weak of intellect, he has allowed himself to be taken and ensnared since assuming the tiara, in a net from which he no longer knows how to disentangle himself. And if matters follow their natural course, he will be driven out of Rome. These prophetic words were written by the Austrian State Chancellor, Prince Metternich, to his ambassador in Paris in October 1847. Their subject was Giovanni Maria Mastai Ferretti, the former Bishop of Imola and Archbishop of Spoleto, who, the previous year at the age of 54, had been elected Pope Pius IX. By the liberals of Italy and indeed all Western Europe, the news of his election had been greeted with excitement and delight. The new pontiff, it seemed, was one of themselves. In his first month of office, he amnestied more than 1,000 political prisoners and exiles. A few weeks later, he was giving garden parties for both sexes at the Quirinal. Meanwhile, he actively encouraged plans for railways, anathema to his predecessor Gregory XVI, who called them chemins d'enfer, and for gas lighting in the streets of Rome. He established a free, or very nearly free, press. He made a start on tariff reform, introduced laymen into the papal government, and abolished the ridiculous law whereby Jews were obliged to listen to a Christian sermon once a week. Mobbed wherever he went, he was the most popular man in Italy. But his reputation carried its own dangers. Every political demonstration, from the mildest to the most revolutionary, now claimed his support. His name appeared on 1,000 banners, frequently proclaiming causes which he violently opposed. With the outbreak of the revolutions of 1848, his position became more untenable. Still, Pio Nono, Pio Nono, Pio Nono. The name became a battle cry, endlessly chanted by one mob after another as it surged through the streets of city after city. When the Pope concluded one speech with the words, "God bless Italy," his words were immediately seen as an endorsement of the popular dream of a united Italy, freed forever from Austrian rule. Pius, it need hardly be said, had no desire to see Italy united. Apart from anything else, what then would become of the Papal States? In short, the Pope now found himself on a runaway train. His only hope was to try to apply the brakes in whatever way he could. Already by the end of January of that fateful year, the spate of new constitutions had begun. Ferdinand had given one to Naples on the 29th. In Florence, just a week later, the Grand Duke had offered another. On March 5, after the Paris Revolution and the flight of Louis-Philippe, King Charles Albert of Savoy had granted one in Turin. Then, on 13 March, it had been the turn of Vienna, and Metternich himself had taken to his heels. This was the most important news of all. New hope surged in the breast of every Italian patriot, who, as always, looked to the Vatican for a lead. There was nothing for it. On the 15th, Pope Pius granted a constitution to Rome. It was not exaggeratedly liberal. His chief minister, Cardinal Antonelli, had seen to that. Nor, as things turned out, did it last very long, but it served its purpose. Pius, unwilling as he was to spearhead European revolution, could hardly be seen to be lagging behind. On 24 March, the very day that Charles Albert declared war on Austria, General Giovanni Durando led the advance guard of a papal army out of Rome to protect the northern frontier of the papal states against any possible Austrian attack. This was conceived as a purely defensive measure, but the warmongers refused to accept it as such. Austria, they claimed, had declared war on Christian Italy. This was, therefore, a holy war, a crusade, with the divine purpose of driving the invader from the sacred Italian soil. Pope Pius was predictably furious. Never for a moment would he have condoned such a policy of aggression, least of all against a Catholic nation. It was clearly essential for him to make his position clear once and for all. The result was the so-called allocution of 29 April 1848. Far from leading the campaign for a united Italy, he declared, he actively opposed it. God-fearing Italians should forget the whole idea of unification and once again pledge their loyalty to their individual princes. The allocution was welcomed by King Ferdinand, who saw it as a perfect excuse to recall the army he had sent north under General Pepe. Pepe, to his eternal credit, was to disobey him and lead 2,000 of his men to the defense of Venice. By true Italian patriots up and down the country, on the other hand, the news was received with horror. Yet, as things turned out, the cause of unification was almost unaffected. The movement was now so widespread as to be unstoppable. The only real damage done was to the reputation of Pius himself. Until now, he had been a hero. Henceforth, he was a traitor. Moreover, the allocution had shown, as perhaps nothing else could have shown, just how powerless the Pope was to influence events. All his fantastic popularity disappeared overnight. Now it was his turn to look revolution in the face. For the next 7 months, he struggled to hold the situation. But when his chief minister, Count Pellegrino Rossi, was hacked to death as he was about to enter the chancellery, he realized that Rome was no longer safe for him. On 24 November, disguised as a simple priest, he slipped secretly out of the Quirinal Palace by a side door and fled to Gaeta, where King Ferdinand gave him a warm welcome. At first, the Piedmontese army enjoyed a measure of success. All too soon, however, on 24 July, Charles Albert was routed at Custoza, a few miles southwest of Verona. He fell back on Milan, with